Thank you to Audible.com for supporting The Partially Examined Life. For a free 30-day trial, go to audible.com/PEL. That's audible.com/PEL. If you go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/store, you're going to see some new stuff. The first of which is the 2016 Partially Examined Life calendar, featuring the ultra-cool artwork of Sterling Bartlett with informative, amusing text. The second thing, just now released, is the new Mark Lint album, Songs from the Partially Examined Life. That is 17 songs, all the best ones written specifically for this podcast over the last few years. The kind of songs which, as you should know, are intended to be listened to repeatedly until they stick into your brain. So we've ordered a limited number of CDs, which of course make much cooler gifts than mere MP3s. But you can also get a very cheap MP3 copy if you want. Lastly, we've created some other kinds of merch, including a very nifty Nietzsche mug. Thanks and enjoy the episode. You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 129 is something like, is religious faith irrational? And we read a bunch of snippets of articles presented in the final chapter of Paul Helm's 1999 Oxford Reader, Faith and Reason, which includes selections by Antony Flew, Alvin Plantinga, Richard Swinburne, William Alston, Peter Van Inwagen, and others. You can join the discussion, get the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Lintonmeyer, broadcasting from the Atheist Hermeneutic Circle in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Alwyn in godless Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Nathan Gilmore, both a sinner and finite, in Athens, Georgia.
And this is Rob Dyer in evidentially beautiful Belleville, Illinois.
All right, so this is a groundbreaking episode for us in that we have two guests that don't know each other, that are from different things. We've seldom had two guests, and those guys were in the same band. So, but really, you Christians, you're all in the same band.
Absolutely. It's two on two today, gentlemen.
But before the guest introductions, let me just read through the list of readings. We read 14 very short articles, Antony Flew, The Presumption of Atheism, Norwood Russell Hansen, The Agnostic's Dilemma, Richard Swinburne, The World and Its Order, Alvin Plantinga, Is Belief in God Properly Basic? Merrill Westfall, Sin and Reason. Stephen Kahn, The Irrelevance of Proof to Religion. Basil Mitchell, Faith and Criticism. William Alston, Experience in Religious Belief. Peter Van Inwagen, Clifford's Principle. Again, Richard Swinburne, The Voluntariness of Faith. The editor Paul Helm, Faith and Merit. And finally, Robert M. Adams, The Sin of Unbelief. I've put that list in our episode description, so if you get confused by all the names flying around here, just look at the screen of your mobile device or computer or whatever. So this is one we had long planned. So Rob is the producer of the God Complex Radio podcast.
Yes, indeed.
And I was on that a couple years ago, and that's when we decided that, you know, this was supposed to be an interfaith, what is the appropriate term for an exchange? But our scheduling, our scheduling is slow enough that it took Nathan Gilmore from the Christian Humanist podcast to come along and say, why don't you do that with us instead, to kick us in gear and say, we're never going to do this twice, so let's just do it once. But this has been hot on the top of our minds since we did a couple of we did one on the arguments for the existence of God, and we did one right after that on the new atheists. So this on faith is one Wes and I have long talked about, of doing something. Yeah, you know, the arguments for the existence of God are sort of beside the point. Our guest on that episode, who ran a religious blog, you know, was like, well, basically, we could discuss them rationally because none of us had really any stake in them. It sort of was irrelevant to your faith. Well, so if arguments for the existence of God aren't what faith hinges on, well, there still must be some rationale behind faith, whether it's I am faithful because it lets me pursue a better life, or I am faithful because I did Pascal's wager and determined that I would rather be wrong and harmlessly deluded for my life than wrong and end up in hell, or many other things that could sort of broadly be considered rationality. So maybe let's have our guests introduce themselves, say something about your podcast, and maybe give us a little opening statement. Nathan, you want to start?
Certainly. I am Nathan Gilmore. I am a professor of English at a small Christian college in Franklin Springs, Georgia. That's in the Athens area. Been there for about 7 years. My PhD is in English, but before that I did a master's degree in biblical studies and a master's degree in English. And before that even, I was at a small Christian liberal arts college where I did a double major in English and philosophy. Our podcast is the Christian Humanist Podcast. We've been going since about 2009. We try to release an episode a week during the school year, and it really started when three of us who were good friends there in the PhD program moved to different states or different parts of Georgia and decided we wanted to keep having the coffee shop conversations we used to have as grad students, and we've just kind of been doing that ever since. So we're now up to 6 different shows, 15 on-air personalities. We're having a great time at it.
Yeah, it's a really good chemistry there. Obvious affinities to what we do here. Maybe the biggest difference is that you're all, well, you say, I know you're an English guy, but you also teach philosophy there, right? You teach the philosophy course. I know it's a small school.
Yes, that's honestly one of the joys of teaching at a small liberal arts college like that is that I teach Old English for foreign language credit. I teach literature classes, rhetorical theory, literary theory, intro to philosophy. Whatever they will let me get in front of a classroom to teach, I'll do it.
Christian humanism, we should explain, is not, when I first heard that, as you explained on your first episode, it just means Christians who read the humanities. It doesn't mean kind of some weird hybrid of humanism, because it's what we think of humanism as secular humanism is right. What most people, that brings to mind.
Right. Our neighbors on the internet, christianhumanist.net, are dedicated to precisely what you just named, but we at christianhumanist.org really are trying to we're trying to reclaim the legacy of Desiderius Erasmus and cats like that who want to do the best philosophy we can for the sake of the kingdom of God. So that's kind of what our thing is. We have a blast doing it. I mean, that's my main thing.
Well, and some of the discussions are sharing your experiences of that culture, which I've been really dipping into your podcast over the last couple of weeks. So, you know, I'm always fascinated by different academic niches and what folks get really excited about. But then you've got a bunch of episodes also like on more current movies and things. And there's nothing particularly religious even about a lot of them. Like they're just plain old, good, interesting academic discussions.
Oh, sure. We did the original Star Wars trilogy, did an episode on Ghostbusters, the Back to the Future movies. So yeah, I mean, you know, whatever it occurs to us that might be interesting to talk about and dig into from the perspective of Christian confession, that's kind of what we do.
And some of it, it's you all read the same book and talk about it kind of like we do here. More often, it seems like you're a little more organized than we are, that you rotate. One of you is the host and kind of treat it more like a panel discussion than a free-for-all. And it's, hey, Michael, why don't you talk, you know, give the historical background of this thing. And then, David, you talk about this, that, you know, that it's three scholars sharing the depth of their experience on these things just as often. I mean, I guess more you've done so many episodes, you've run out of things that you before that you already know about. So you're reading more stuff fresh.
Right. And a lot of times the stuff that we read about in the 90 minutes before we started recording.
And then switching over to Rob, so God Complex, I had listened to a lot of that when I was on it a couple of years ago. I know, Rob, that format is more two hosts, neither of which is you, but you occasionally appear and certainly are very involved in what's going on there. But just interviewing people about their books, and it's aimed at the clergy more or less, but is of general interest too, but there's a lot of just and sort of in the liberal Christian spectrum. Does that all sound right?
Yeah, that's basically it. One of the things we try to do is give voice to some modern Christian thinkers that maybe wouldn't normally get a voice. And these are usually folks who have written a book, and we're trying to help them along and promote what they're doing and their way of bringing us into new ways of thinking about God and our faith. And yeah, the host, Carol Howard Merritt and Derek Weston, they do all the hard work of reading the book and really getting into it and then interviewing the guest. And I'm just the producer guy in the background trying to keep things moving along. I think that what happened was that I listened to the podcast for a couple of years and I was calling in or sending emails in with like all these different suggestions about the podcast. And finally they said, well, why don't you do it? And so I was like, okay, I'll produce it. That's fine. And it wasn't too bad for me. My background actually originally is in electrical engineering. I'm a second career clergy. In addition to helping out with the podcast, I'm the pastor and head of staff at First United Presbyterian Church in Belleville, Illinois, which is a suburb of St. Louis. it's really been interesting to me as we go through both the producing of that podcast. And again, it just came to me as we were going through the readings this week, preparing for this podcast, how interesting it is to try to insert in the real life of a Christian congregation into some of these discussions. Because so often us preacher types, we get out of seminary and it's like, it's as if we've been trained to work in churches that simply don't exist. And so we get out there and we're shocked to find out, what? You're not all reading Calvin? What's going on here? And so when I started through these readings this week, I got to tell you, I was like, oh, good Lord, this doesn't apply to anything I see in the regular church. And then we started to get into Kahn. And the
Stephen Kahn, not Immanuel Kant.
Kahn as in the Wrath of Kahn.
Well, actually, I was going to make a connection there, but I'll hold back.
Yeah, these were mostly like 2-page articles. Well, so Wes, why don't you tell us what you came? I mean, the reading selection was your idea. Really, driving the topic was your idea. Say something about what you wanted to get out of this.
So coming out of our last discussion of the proofs for the existence of God, I was more interested in this question of whether religious faith is reasonable, because I think part of the gist of some of the current cultural trends like New Atheism is not just that there's no proof, but there's no evidence for God. And because there's no evidence, that believers are just crazy. Faith is just, it's irrational and incompatible with science. Although we didn't read specifically about the relationship between faith and the sciences tonight, we're doing a more general discussion. That's sort of one of the narratives. So yeah, I wanted to get into this question of religious epistemology, the broader question of whether it's, regardless of whether one actually believes, of whether it's fair to call believers crazy.
or the really nice way that one of the authors puts it, noetically substandard.
Yes, that was quite endearing.
It has to do with mind. I had to look up what that was.
Because you don't have ancient Greek.
Noesis and noema, that didn't tell me anything that they have to do with them. I know, right. Husserl. So who wants to start? I mean, do we want to start with these first, the first couple selections in here? Antony Flew, The Presumption of Atheism, and Norwood Russell Hansen's The Agnostic's Dilemma sort of go together, and they, you know, have to do with this, exactly what you were saying, Wes, that wouldn't you think in normal life that you should have reasons for the things you believe? Right. And if you want to make some claim, then people will say, well, why do you say that? And you have to point out some experience you have, or there are a number of things you could say, but there has to be some reason. So if Flew, the way he puts that is the presumption of atheism is just if you're arguing for something positive, the existence of something, whether it be the existence of God or the Loch Ness Monster or the teapot that exists on the other side of the moon, which is Bertrand Russell's example, I believe, then the burden of proof is on you. What do you think of that claim? That's sort of, I'll say, prejudices the case, but intentionally from Flew's perspective.
Well, I would say that I'll accept that. I don't have any problem with being told that, okay, as a believer, you've got to step up to the plate and prove this, somehow demonstrate this. I think that that's been one of the problems with the Christian faith, is that we've gotten to rely so long on culture and social pressures and norms that in a way we've become kind of lazy about standing up for the basis of our belief. And so, you know, as I read it, I just kind of thought, yeah, that's fine. I'll take it. Give me the ball. Let's go.
And see, as I read it, I had a flashback to every threaded message board from 1998 I ever frequented. This business of the onus lies on the person making the proposition, you know. Yeah, I mean, I recognize the argument. It's one of those that on its own terms, you're right. I mean, it is valid. It does stand the test of logic. But it's one of those things, and I'm sure we're going to get to this later on in the episode, that when I get to thinking about it, it doesn't really produce any change in conviction for me. Now, that might be a defect on my part, but when I read Antony Flew, I say, yeah, that's interesting, but that's about as far as I get with it.
Well, is that because you think that, fine, the burden, like Rob was just saying, the burden of proof is on us, the theists, but we can meet that burden of proof. That's fine. That's what Richard Swinburne that we read argues. You know, anybody that actually, well, Swinburne goes so far as, yeah, those arguments that you gave in the past episode, you know, because he's talking to us directly, on the existence of God,
of course.
Those actually work, and they work splendidly. He's a very cheery fellow, but most of the other folks we read here, Plantinga and others, want to say Flew is wrong, that there's something wrong with asking for justification, and we can get what the various views against that are. But, I mean, I know Wes, when we were co-TAs for, I think, our first course at the University of Texas, and the prof that we were under used this idea of the burden of proof, and you just thought that was ridiculous. That was a bad importation from the law courts, right? Where the notion of burden of proof makes sense.
How do you remember this and I don't remember this?
I don't know why. My memory attaches to particular ideas like this less than to people or events.
Okay.
The way that I learned to think about this, largely in too many hours spent on those goofy threaded message boards, is to pose the question, who is it that gets to decide what is positive and what is negative? So in other words, to posit a universe that is self-contained without reference to deity, is that a positive claim or is that a claim minus one element?
Yeah.
The way that I imagine things is, and I know that I'm being influenced by other thinkers here in the, oh, and shoot, do we still have to follow the name-dropping rule?
No, go ahead.
All right.
We read a dozen different authors.
Yeah, we read too many people referring to too many other people to abide by that rule.
Okay, very good. Okay, so I am allowed to say Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein's basic approach to things is to keep posing the question, why is it that you consider that claim the basic one upon which others are built rather than vice versa? And of course, the methodology of the thought experiment is precisely to reframe the narrative so that the onus of proof keeps moving around, so that this notion that this is a legal proceeding assumes a great deal as far as what kind of discourse we're having.
I guess to frame the larger debate, we should bring in this term evidentialism. This is the idea that we're not justified in believing anything, although to be precise, Flew is actually talking about knowledge, so knowledge claims. But we're not justified in believing anything unless we have evidence for it, or unless you can phrase that in different ways. And basically, yeah, you have to have positive evidence for anything you believe. And I think in many cases, that's not exactly the way belief works.
And honestly, if I can turn over to Hansen's piece real quick, the scenario that he lays out that would be proper evidence for the existence of God, I'll admit that when I read this, and let me just summarize it real quickly, he says that if a bearded figure looking somewhat like Zeus appeared in the sky, breaking through the clouds with glowing lights all around him, and that not just one person, but all of the people saw this at the same time, and this thing said, all of you who are making arguments against the existence of God, just knock it off. And Rob, I'll be interested to hear your take on this, because I come from a more evangelical sort of background. But if that happened, I imagine I would be the first in line to start telling people that wasn't God, whatever that was.
Yeah. Throughout my discernment of whether or not to go into the ministry and even afterwards, I used to say often to folks, all I want is a 20-foot Jesus appearing at the end of my bed, telling me what to do with my life. And I have to say, like, no, that would be really, really bad, because if the 20-foot Jesus shows up, first of all, he's all hunched over because I don't have that high a ceiling. And second of all, that would just be really frightening. And I would consider myself to have gone insane, not to have had a divine revelation. So, you know, I think that giving that type of case and saying that, okay, this would have this effect, I don't know. That's not the way it would land with me, I have to admit, despite all my faith and trust. And I certainly have had my moments where I've felt the presence of God, but never quite a Zeus-like figure breaking through the clouds. I did notice that at the end of the Flew article, I did write myself a little note that said, yeah, this is fine about like accepting the burden of proof. But let's just all acknowledge that this is kind of a new way of thinking, that if we were back in the 3rd or 4th century, we'd be looking at the atheist and saying, well, you're the one with the crazy off-the-wall belief.
So, I'm not sure you need to accept the burden of proof here, because that assumes that evidentialism is right. I mean, the other way to go is to say that belief can be warranted even in cases where you don't have definitive evidence.
Right. And see, I guess in Hansen's scenario, I would think that space aliens who received a transmission of Monty Python and the Holy Grail had landed. Again, because I don't really have much at stake. I don't have a horse in the race with the sentence God exists so much as I do with we believe that in one God, the Father, the creator of heaven and earth, so on and so forth. So the particularism of the Christian creed, it strikes me, would fly in the face of an apparition like that. And Rob, am I overplaying this? I want to toss this back to you because you're the clergy here.
you're going into the deep end a little bit, but I'd be willing to go out there with you a while. You know, I actually wrote down next to, in my notes next to this example with the Zeus, I thought, okay, good point. But I think that to me, it was just a little bit of a distraction, that example that was given by Hansen. And I thought that the comments that were made about that, you know, in the beginning where he said that it might remain reasonable for one to persist as a believer, even after further thought, has led him to deny God's existence. I mean, that's going to start tying in with some of the later readings that we had about this kind of inertia of belief that is there, not just in faith, but in science itself. That's they call it the principle of tenacity in the Mitchell article, which is much later. We cannot flip-flop around based on every little bit of evidence or consideration of evidence that comes forward. And these arguments that they throw in our court, I appreciate what you're saying, Wes, and saying like, okay, I don't think necessarily the burden is on you, and maybe you're assuming some things when you take it on. For me, it's kind of an acknowledgement that looking at where our culture is now, like not in the grand cosmos of perfect philosophical argument and seeking of truth with a capital T, I need to accept the onus. But I think that in the current culture, given the current climate, I do feel as a person of faith that I better take that on.
So when we ask this question of whether faith can be rational, we have to say what rationality is, right? And one way to say that is to talk about the necessity of evidence. But then we ask the question of what evidence is. And so in the Hansen case, this idea that we need empirical evidence, we need God as an apparition in front of us in order to believe, that's a very strict criterion for evidence. The way I view this is that to be rational, it's very important that it not contradict other things we accept, right? It's important that there not be something contradictory about belief in God. And then the other part of it is just that it be well-motivated. In other words, you can think of God as a kind of theory meant to explain something. And even though it's not one that we can conduct empirical experiments as a follow-up to confirm or disconfirm the theory, that doesn't mean the theory doesn't have explanatory value or is well motivated. So for instance, Russell's teapot example, or I think another popular one these days is the
flying spaghetti monster. I was wondering when he would make an appearance.
Yeah, those are really, I think, poor examples because the teapot or the spaghetti monster, there's no rationale for them. They may be in the same position as God in the sense that there's no empirical evidence for or against. On the other hand, they're not theories that are trying to explain anything. They don't fit into scheme in that way. There's no explanatory value to them. And also, they're empirical entities. And I think in many cases, the standards that we are applying to empirical entities are more stringent. We do tend to think, well, yeah, my presumption is that I'm not going to believe in the spaghetti monster until I see evidence of it. But the whole point of God as a theory is that he's not spatiotemporal. He's not even a he necessarily. But so,
right. Thank you.
Yeah, so God is this non-empirical entity, and we wouldn't really want, and, you know, although I think different religious traditions have at different times treated God as if he could come down and interact with us in one form or another. But I think in some ways, it's kind of a setback. The apparition is, and I think you guys were kind of alluding to this, it'd be kind of a setback theologically if God were to manifest himself empirically, right? Because it doesn't fit in with the whole point of God as a theory, which is to explain the spatiotemporal as a whole and to stand outside it in that sense.
When you got to the Plantinga article, we even get the God versus the Great Pumpkin, which I thought was quite hilarious.
And, yeah, so that's another version of the same thing.
Yeah, of exactly what you're saying. I think one of the things that I felt was missing when I was reading the Hansen article was that I wanted to say, well, what about some humility or an acceptance of the limits of reason? I find myself walking into the subject of really anything about God with a huge amount of humility and a willingness to accept the limits of my own ability to reason things out. And so, when we say that we have to limit everything to evidence and to reason, that presupposes that is the key to truth and reality.
We do need to have some standards, right? We need something in between. It's a free-for-all, and you can believe whatever you want. You can believe in the pumpkin, the great pumpkin.
Right. Somewhere between evidence and great pumpkin.
And then, or treating every problem as if it must be resolvable by scientific inquiry or it's meaningless.
Another troubling aspect of Anthony Flew came in the article that Mark sent along in the email, the theology and falsification article.
So just some background. Flew, though, this particular article that we read is from 1976. He was sort of best known for a very short article from 1950, Theology and Falsification, which was something presented at some society that C.S. Lewis started, where they would just give these talks to each other. And
yes, the Socratic Society, I think.
Exactly. And he claims that it might be the most widely read philosophical publication of the second half of the 20th century, translated into 40 languages. So it seemed worth pulling out since it's like a page long.
Certainly. And in this piece, he presents articles very similar to the ones we've been summarizing up to this point. But it ends with a question that on its face makes a certain degree of sense. But when I started thinking about it ethically, I mean, it really just churned my stomach. The question reads thus: what would have to occur or to have occurred to constitute for you a disproof of the love of or the existence of God? It is a question that turns God into an empirical entity that can be proved or disproved. But again, thinking about the way that religious faith has actually shaped my own story as a human being, this just struck me as strange ethically. It would be as if when I got married, I were asking myself on the way down the aisle, what would have to occur or to have occurred for me to get a divorce right now? That is a question that strikes me as something you might have to confront if circumstances altered beyond what you could anticipate. But to start asking that preemptively strikes me as ethically squirrely.
Right. Well, so a couple of the later articles that we took on get into that kind of the metaphor of faith, not just as believing a proposition without what we would normally think of as evidence, but faith as trust. And there's something self-reinforcing about that, that in fact, mm-hmm. that article, Robert M. Adams, The Sin of Unbelief, he says you can't separate the idea of not believing God when he speaks and not believing the proposition God exists, or not believing in God or God's goodness. Mm-hmm. And so he specifically says, I'm not going to try to get into the mind of an atheist, but for somebody that already is in the position where they have theistic leanings, they've had some religious sense, they've heard the calling in some sense, for those people to then have doubts, it becomes very personal. Once you've heard that, well, then if you start to change your mind, like, well, maybe I was just wrong about this. It's not just a matter of I'm changing my belief. There's a little part of me that will always still believe. And if I turn to that little part of me, it's going to say, you are betraying God. You're not just changing your mind. You're actually, it's a betrayal. It's, which to me is a pernicious, I was going to say hermeneutic circle. I'm not sure if that's the proper use of that term, which does show up in here, but it's definitely a circle, I guess a similar one that I was going to bring up when Wes was talking about how the flying spaghetti monster and the great pumpkin and these other entities don't have explanatory value, whereas God is supposed to have explanatory value is, well, you only think that the great pumpkin doesn't have explanatory value because of original sin. It's one of the other articles that we read, which is you might think that we could just use religious phenomenology, something like, come on, don't you, like Plantinga says this, one of the guys positively arguing for religious faith here, don't you, when you reflect on the starry sky, isn't it very natural to say, wow, that's such an impressive creation of God? That's just something that is sort of built into human beings tend to do that. And the response to that, Merrill Westfall, one of the other things we read, Sin and Reason.
Right. Also one of my favorite living philosophers.
Yeah, he brings up John Calvin, as Plantinga does. Really, no, according to original sin, we do not naturally go towards God. It's only sort of after you've bought into it, after you've been cleansed, that your intuitions realign. And this really is, Westfall talks specifically about the hermeneutic circle. The hermeneutic circle being that you only can understand something, you only can gain new knowledge by bringing your old knowledge, bringing your presumptions to bear. You can't just start, you know, rationality sort of sees, oh, you know, if you just start with an open mind and look at the evidence, then you'll all come to the same conclusion. Well, a lot of these folks like Westfall are saying, there's no such thing as an open mind. We all come with these things that will push us toward one way or another. And just like we've talked in this podcast a lot about Nietzsche really ad hominem attacking believers, that from the point of view of that he's coming from, there's something just kind of sick to wanting to give yourself up to a higher being. Come on, just be a man, stand up And we saw in some of these readings exactly the same kind of ad hominem the opposite way. No, no, no. It's original sin. It's that you non-believers are just so corrupt that that's what ultimately is driving your belief.
Mm-hmm. But Westfall is a consistent enough Paulinist that he also wants to say, believers, you also are beset with original sin. So whereas you might not be inclined towards atheism, you are inclined towards idolatry.
Let's just clarify, Paulinist meaning Apostle Paul, not a lover of pollen.
Not a pollinator.
I nominalized that, and that was terribly pretentious. I apologize. But yes, he's a consistent enough reader of St. Paul, there we go, that he wants to say that it's not only...
I had your back on that, Nathan.
It's not only the atheist who is beset by original sin, but it's also the believer. And this is one of the places where I think Westfall is the strongest, because he says to the believers, okay, do you say that every kind of belief is going to be, you know, affected by sin? Well, in that case, you should turn that critical eye on yourself and realize that every prayer that you speak is effectively a prayer to an idol, and that your hope is not that you have a concept that corresponds to the creator of heavens and earth, but that that being, whoever that being is, can hear what it is that you pray, even though your prayers are misdirected.
Okay, so Rob, before you weigh in on that, we just need to stop for a minute and talk about our sponsors. The first of which is a returning sponsor, Audible. Audible.com is a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 180,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals, and of course, philosophy. So for instance, you can get a book by one of our authors, Alvin Plantinga's Where the Conflict Really Lies, Science, Religion, and Naturalism. You can get titles by The Great Courses, like the one on philosophy of religion, another one on philosophy and religion in the West, another one called Science and Religion, Why Evil Exists, and one specifically on Augustine. You can get Alain de Botton's Religion for Atheists, A Non-Believer's Guide to the Uses of Religion. There are books on all the different world religions and books by all the new atheists. And you can get several books that I narrated, including biographies of philosophers like Nietzsche, Rousseau, and Karl Marx. Now, for Partially Examined Life audience members, Audible is offering a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/PEL. You'll be able to download a free title and start listening right away. Just so you know, Audible has free apps so you can download and listen on your iPhone, Android, Windows Phone, Kindle Fire, plus iPod, and over 500 MP3 players. To sign up for the free trial, you will need to initially log in through your PC or Mac, but after that, you can download one of these apps and sign in to use it. And Audible has a great listen guarantee. If you choose a book and decide you don't like it, no worries. You can exchange it for another title anytime, no questions asked. So take advantage of your free Audible trial now by going to audible.com/PEL. All right, now Wes, tell us about Zevia.
Zevia is the zero-calorie, naturally sweetened soda that's clearly different. No sugar, no calories, and no artificial sweeteners make this a cleaner, healthier soda option. Zevia is available in 15 delicious flavors like cream soda, black cherry, cola, ginger ale, and there's even a tonic water. Every flavor is zero calories. You can drink them by themselves, or they also make excellent mixers. I'm actually a big fan of Zevia, especially the root beer flavor. I started drinking it years ago when I wanted to get away from diet sodas that use artificial sweeteners. Really good, and they're not using NutraSweet or Splenda. You can find Zevia online at Amazon.com or at your local grocery or natural food store. And if you go to Zevia.com/podcast, you could win a free six-pack. That's Zevia.com/podcast.
All right, so Rob, I think you're going to say something about Merrill Westfall in his article Sin and Reason, about how original sin has screwed up our ability to reason properly.
Yeah, I really felt like the way that Westfall ended by saying, he says that in any case, for believers to draw a line between themselves and unbelievers and to find the noetic effects of sin only on the other side of that line is closer to epistemological Phariseeism than it is to taking Paul seriously. For unbelief is not only the way of suppressing the truth about God, it is only the most honest. And I mean, I was immediately drawn to the story in the Gospel of Mark in the Bible, with a man wants his son healed, and tells Jesus, well, if you can, and Jesus says, if I can, you know, kind of to him. And the response back, which is probably the most honest prayer that's ever been spoken and certainly recorded in the Bible, is the Father says, I believe, help my unbelief. And that resonates with people. I mean, when you talk about that in a faith setting, that line resonates. At some level, we all understand the idea that whatever it is that we believe, for whatever reason, whether it's some set of evidence we've lined up in our head or just that gut feeling we get, or, you know, we're just two steps above the great pumpkin in our faith development, whatever, there's something that resonates in people with the idea of, I believe, but I need help with my unbelief. From my side of the theological spectrum, it really backs up that Reformed notion that faith is a gift. It's not something that we well up out of an amazing exercise of our will or of reason, but faith is something that comes to us as a gift, despite our brokenness and despite the brokenness of this world. And so we need something more than just a set of reasonings that, to get ourselves there. And here's where I'll name drop a little bit with little Augustine, who said that while it's reason, you know, that brings us to the threshold of faith, it just can't take you through the door. And, you know, there's a real problem that a lot of the theologians of the years had with, they just, how do we explain the fact that we can't figure out this magic formula to get people to believe? You know, there's not that one incredible sermon that just turns the whole, the crowds around. There's not just that one argument or evidence. And where so many have come to rest is to say that there is something that works above our reason or below, however you want to think of it, and that it is a spiritual experience to move into belief. It's not a exercise of will or intellect, which makes it very difficult for us to have this kind of conversation about it. I feel like at times that's used to shut down the argument, and instead I'd like to use that to engage the argument. I do feel like we got that a little bit in the readings, where it wasn't just thrown out there as like, take that. It was thrown out there as like, okay, so let's accept this. Let's stretch the notion of what is something that's a basic belief, and let's stretch that. In the Mitchell article, he really pointed out that, you know, this also applies to science. It's not like science walks around with its pure way of thinking. There's all kinds of biases there that's brought in and in how we approach understanding things about the physical world. Like I said, I don't want that to shut down the argument. I want it to just perhaps color it a little bit.
Right. But I think what Rob was just narrating is why a lot of these questions don't necessarily offend cats like Rob and myself who've spent some time in the pulpit, but they just strike us as alien. The stories that we hear as we talk to people who are coming into the faith and going out of the faith and so on and so forth has so little to do with the onus of proof in a syllogistic throwdown. The stories are complex stories, but they are just in a very different register from what Flew and Hansen, and I would say even Swinburne is doing.
So there's a lot that was just in Rob's speech that I think we got to slow down and unpack. But
oh yeah,
since I see us,
I'm sorry.
This is going to be a long enough discussion. Our normal over two hour discussion. We're still sort of in the realm of opening statements, as far as I'm concerned. So that was Rob's. But I think we might as well throw out the person you brought up first, Rob, Stephen Kahn, the irrelevance of proof to religion. And say a little bit about that, since you're already getting to that point. And that the two things that came out first are that, which is one of the first points I made when we were coming into this. And then I think, was it his or was it Mitchell's? I'm kind of confusing some of these articles. That was just really talking about different points of view. It seems like a very obvious thing, but when you're trying to unpack it philosophically, what actually goes into a point of view? You just think differently about things. I know that Peter Van Inwagen, part of his point was intelligent people disagree about political questions, for instance, and philosophical questions. He talks about, you know, he and David Lewis are discussing this esoteric point in philosophy, and they both understand each other perfectly, but yet they still remain of different minds about this thing. And so what is it? There must be something that is subjective, something that is personal that you're bringing to bear, that's this hermeneutic circle thing or something that makes it so that, you know, different people are coming from different places. And part of what you were just outlining, Rob, actually, you know, is very foreign to me. You say it resonates people with this, I believe, yet help me with my belief. That sounds bizarre to me. And my bringing up the whole John Calvin original sin thing strikes me as a pernicious trap, a pernicious self-reinforcing, this doesn't seem natural to you. But of course it's not going to seem natural to you because your instincts have been perverted by not already being a Christian. From somebody who is coming to things from a view closer to Anthony Flew's, it's a lot to swallow. So if we can make it so that we can understand each other's various positions, or at least the positions as presented in these two-page arguments here, these articles, we'll have made some progress.
Well, yeah, I think that what you've lifted up is to say, okay, as you come at this from different angles, different perspectives, some of this is just going to resonate with you more than others. And I got halfway through the Stephen Kahn article, and I just went back to the beginning of it and wrote, yes, 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 this is the...
Say something about what that article says. I didn't actually say anything about what the content was.
That's it. Well, I'm just going to read from the second paragraph in there where it says, one might expect that religious believers would be vitally interested in discussions on this subject. This is the philosophical proofs on the existence of God. One might suppose that when a proof of God's existence is presented and eloquently defended, believers would be most enthusiastic, and that when a proof is attacked and persuasively refuted, believers would be seriously disappointed. But this is not at all the case. Religious believers seem remarkably uninterested in philosophic proofs for the existence of God. They seem to consider discussion of such proofs as a sort of intellectual game which has no relevance to religious belief or activity. And goes on and gives us a little Kierkegaard and Kaplan after that. It's right. I mean, people of faith seem very uninterested in this. And in my particular context where I am, we are going through a huge emphasis of trying to help people articulate specifically what they believe, to outline what is it that you believe, that by doing that, that might strengthen your resolve and help you in your own faith. And what we're finding is that people just don't think that way. I mean, there's still value to taking the time to sit down and try to articulate the particulars of what you believe, but it does not have the effect of like, ah, there it is, finally, my logical argument. And I think that this must be very frustrating for the atheist that wants to debate the topic. It feels like it's very hard to get onto a common ground to have such a discussion, because the experience of, I think, the average believer just doesn't seem to function out of philosophical proofs. And as I have seen people come to faith in different ways, the former engineer in me wants to just break it down and go, okay, how did this happen? How did this 18-year-old young man suddenly get this fire within him and then want to come forward and be baptized and really jump into this faith? What happened there? And so many times I just cannot excavate it.
Yeah, let's say why Kahn thinks why proof is irrelevant. So I think on page 360, he has a good succinct way of putting it. There's only one possible avenue to God's will. One must undergo a personal experience in which one senses the presence of God and apprehends which of the putative holy books is the genuine one. In other words, one must undergo a self-validating experience, one which carries its own guarantee of infallibility. And then later, in the next paragraph, but notice that if he knows this, he has necessarily validated the existence of God, for unless he is absolutely certain that he has experienced God's presence, he cannot be sure that the message he has received is true. Thus, he has no further need of a proof of God's existence. So this is an interesting idea about what counts as evidence and what doesn't. So, I mean, normally we would think, for instance, that sensory perceptions count as a form of evidence. And the question here is whether these private, inspired experiences of God really can count as evidence. So when he says that proof is irrelevant, I'm not seeing him as saying that evidence is irrelevant. I just think he thinks that the evidence has to be this immediate sort of intuitive type of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Right. The abstract proofs are twice removed from that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the next paragraph, he then gives us another access point to it, because he says, for one who does not undergo what he believes to be such a self-validating experience, several possibilities remain open. He may accept the validity of another person's self-validating experience. And I think that that's where it's saying that you've got to put in personal experience as part of this. And then it moves us out of just simply a philosophical proof that doesn't land with anyone. And I really thought that that was quite an insight there to also talk about that other possibility, which I believe is a very strong one.
Let's unpack that. What does it mean to accept the validity of another person's self-validating experience?
Is it a family member or preacher or something sort of describing the inspiration, and you sort of get caught up in that and then can be eventually led to have that sort of feeling yourself? Is that what's being discussed here?
Let me jump on in this, because this really narrates my own experience with the faith a lot more accurately than the personal, divine, mystical experience. I have not had anything resembling a mystical experience, but in the process of participating in worship and reading in the tradition and existing within Christian communities of various sorts. It's not been a syllogism, but it's been a process of enculturation whereby I've come to understand myself first and foremost as a part of this tradition that stretches back to Jesus and the apostles. I don't think of myself as, for instance, first and foremost an American citizen who happens to check this box on the census form, but I tend to think of myself as someone who is part of this narrative of God's saving the world, who happens to have been born in Indianapolis and now lives in Georgia. It has a lot more to do with finding yourself situated in a certain narrative. And I would submit that when I've talked to friends of mine who have left the faith for various reasons, that tends to be the way that they talk about it as well. You know, they come to think of themselves as inhabiting a different kind of story. It's not a single syllogism, you know, there must be adequate evidence. Evidence is lacking, ergo no God, but rather they come to understand themselves as part of a different kind of a story.
Yes, the identity of story. I think that's a huge point that you're making there, Nathan. And I think that can play to both sides, not just from the theist side, but also from the atheist side.
Oh, certainly. And honestly, that's one of the things I find compelling about Christian theology is that it does locate that, I wouldn't call it sub-rational, but I would call it super-rational. So in other words, there is rationality, plus there are other factors that are important that lead someone towards or away from the faith. Because otherwise, you know, kind of like we talked about, Van Inwagen's point stands here. Otherwise, someone would have articulated an argument at some point and everyone would have become atheist, or someone would have articulated an argument at some point and everyone would have become something else, or you would be able to diagnose everyone who is one or the other as deficient mentally somehow, which I realized Richard Dawkins does, but that aside.
Yeah, Inwagen says on 372, if evidence can include insight or some other incommunicable element, it may be that some of the philosophical and political beliefs of certain people are justified by the evidence available to them. Let's backtrack a little with this burden of proof thing. Mm-hmm. From presumption of atheism. So the two parts of that phrase are separable, the proof part and the burden part. So we've got a few whole other articles, and mostly we've been talking here about the proof part, what's going to count as evidence. But just to let's just kind of check the boxes off to get the content of the flu article out of the way and maybe move through the articles and get a little more order in the listener's mind of what each of these says, at least the top four or five of them. So the idea was, the first thing, Nathan, you had made the point that you would think Occam's razor would say, this is Flew's term, that in the absence of evidence, it's more parsimonious to disbelieve, right? Mm-hmm. You just leave the thing out. And it sounds like arguing for a God is an entity. So does that entity exist? And this is exactly the way that Hansen was talking about it. And the example that he gave is there is an oviparous bat, an egg-laying bat.
I love that example, by the way.
And if you were arguing there is such a thing, then you need to just produce that. If you're arguing that there is no such thing, well, you can't definitively show that there is no such thing, but you could look and look and look at every single bat and see, okay, that one doesn't lay out. You could just look at all the occurrences of observation in the world, and it becomes a matter of induction. But what do you think of that? The idea that asserting that God exists is making the positive claim. Nathan, you were saying that, no, actually, they're both making a descriptive claim about the universe. One is a universe run by God, originated by God, lying in God.
Right. A creation, in other words.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And the other is a self-contained universe, and that those are sort of equal complexity. Occam's razor does not tell you to pick one over the other.
Right. So the contest between those two kinds of narratives, again, is not a matter of the presence or non-presence of an empirical entity so much as it is an aesthetic contest about which sort of world it is more compelling to live in. This is where, again, there are forces beyond the syllogism that make that kind of determination. So again, you know, I think Flew and Hansen present some very interesting arguments, and I think they're good demonstrations of certain kind of argumentative logic. But ultimately, it doesn't necessarily produce any kind of conviction, simply because, like you were alluding to, God is not an entity among entities, but is creator of being itself. So it's an entirely different kind of order of predicates that apply to God, if that makes any sense.
We're just in a culture now where it seems to make more sense to put the burden of proof onto the theist. But the idea that a universe just either has always just existed and that's it, or spontaneously came into existence without any type of divine character in the narrative, that would have seemed the most unreasonable position, which would require you to prove it back in the day. And I think that, you know, when I started off by saying, hey, fine, I'll take the ball, give it to me, that's just for me an acknowledgement of like, well, this is where our culture is now. But I don't think you can argue in a timeless philosophical way that automatically the burden of proof is on the theist.
I think someone might respond, though, that the reason why we are there culturally is because science explains the things that religion used to be thought
was invented
to explain and explains them in a more satisfying way, which goes to show in some sense that when we talk about what's rational, it's a kind of normative idea. It's an idea of concerning intellectual hygiene or what are the good habits of thinking and believing and so on and so forth. That's an interesting part of this. But I think, yeah, so it's not just that we're willy-nilly here culturally. It's because there are competing explanations to God that have, for many people, eclipsed God as an explanation.
Right. And Wes, I'm glad you brought up the notion of the explanatory device, because that strikes me as a narrative that stacks the deck about as much as the original sin one does. If you tell a story in which human beings in various times and various places invent machinery to explain physical phenomena, you are already telling a story in which God will give way to quarks, right? Just as if you tell the story of the world is created and our gifts are bodies, the proper response is gratitude, and yet some of these creatures opt to say that there is no God, that's also stacking the deck. I guess in my mind, I can't think of a story that doesn't stack the deck, and that's why it ends up becoming an aesthetic contest rather than a...
I'm not sure, though. So, for instance, I think that the cosmological argument, even though it fails as a proof of God, actually shows that God as a theory is well-motivated.
Okay.
Just because it's not a definitive proof doesn't show that there are actually interesting and good reasons to postulate a God as the cause of the world, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's not going to be a cause in the typical sense that we think of as a cause. It's not going to be a empirical, spatio-temporal type of cause. And he's not going to be an entity in the typical way we think of that, as an appearance among appearances. So it's a strange sort of theory. And yeah, of course, speaking from a hyper-rational, agnostic or atheist point of view, but it seems to me to be a well-motivated one, even if you accept that challenge. That's the...
Right. And I guess I would reply to that would be a good motivation if that's the way we told the story. But most versions of Islam and Judaism and Christianity that I'm aware of tell stories in which God takes the initiative as an agent to approach humanity, not that humanity posits God as an explanation. And again, to adjudicate between those two stories strikes me as an exercise not in syllogistic reasoning, but a contest of storytelling.
And so the way Flew puts this is, what would justify a presumption of atheism or the other way around? And it depends on your ends. And we also saw this, we have a past episode on William James, The Will to Believe. And the way he puts it is it more important to you to avoid being wrong, so you should just suspend judgment until you're sure of something? Or is it more important to, you know, he's pro-religion, at least some kind of religion, to live with the benefits that religion gives you? The way Carl Jung puts it, is it easier to live thinking that the house is about to fall down, or is it...
There is a first step to that argument. It's the Kantian step, which is to say that we can't evaluate God in scientific terms. And that's where pragmatism sort of comes into play. It's in that position where we don't have good scientific or empirical reasons to say either way whether or not there is a God. That's when the pragmatic concerns operate freely, basically. And then we can say, what is it that's most valuable to us?
I was reading that into Flew, that it's not just that he's saying, like some of the other authors, that if you're going to argue for God, then you need to produce evidence. He's famous with that 1950 paper for being sort of the first new atheist, or the old atheist. I don't know what the appropriate category. But so he doesn't think that evidence is going to be forthcoming. So by saying the ball is in your court, he's trying to finish up the game right there. He's fully aware that that is what he's doing. So he thinks that, okay, so we can talk about, why do we care about the presumption of innocence in a law court? Well, because it's more important for us to not punish innocent people than it is to catch every last possibly guilty person. And he gives the example of, what about a totalitarian state where their interest is really just to show their power? And it's much more important for them to come down as hard as possible. They would have the opposite presumption. But the presumption here is that there is a common culture. So he thinks that it's, well, what we're about is gaining knowledge. And we know about gaining knowledge from other things that we do. And if, let's imagine a colleague of yours performed a discreditable action. Well, you would demand evidence of that. You wouldn't want to just jump ahead and condemn the person. So he thinks that's just a norm in our culture, that for having knowledge, you need evidence. And so why wouldn't that apply here as well? And it sounds like, Nathan, you're saying by this talk of competing stories that we don't actually have a common culture. I mean, I know, Nathan, you particular with your scholarship are committed to a point of view that is pre-Enlightenment, frankly, and sort of see that that's...
But also, is the believer in God really claiming that they have knowledge of God? That's the sort of step here in this argument, which Kant, for instance, would reject. Knowledge already implies the empirical. Knowledge already implies this scientific domain.
Right.
You can use, quote-unquote, knowledge about God, perhaps, but then you're using it an entirely different way, and different kinds of rules apply there.
Right, and here's where my pedigree as a mid-90s postmodernist, I mean, are definitely showing. But yeah, I mean, I would agree that I don't consider common narratives to be something that occur naturally. I think that common narratives are the functions of historical communities and historical traditions, and I think that entering into one of those communities from another is certainly something that involves logical syllogisms, and I would say it's nothing less, but I would also be reticent to say that it's not something more. I think I got all my negatives lined up there.
Yeah, I'm a little confused by what you...
So in other words, I think that one of the things that I see in Flew and Hansen is that they want to treat the question of God simply as this question of evidence without calling into question, okay, well, first of all, what does evidence mean? What does knowledge mean? Like you just said, I keep going back to this sort of phenomenological take on things. But in my own experience, again, just in conversations with folks who either convert to the faith from agnosticism, atheism, or people who become atheist after having been in the faith for some span of time, the logical problems that Flew and Hansen are often involved, but the story is almost always more complex than that.
Hansen's article is called The Agnostic's Dilemma.
Yes, yes.
And he's saying not only kind of making the point that we've already made that, well, if you can't produce God, like, you know, it would just be like producing an oviparous bat, then the default should be that you don't buy it, that that's just the way induction works. But he puts this, that it's not just a matter of, well, we haven't located God yet. We haven't located the oviparous bat yet, but the agnostic is actually being inconsistent. The agnostic begins as a fact gatherer, right? Because you consider that, well, it's possible that there could be proof that God exists. That situation that Rob described of the 20-foot Jesus at the foot of your bed. Although I would believe that the 20-foot Jesus would have the power to both be 20 feet tall and yet fit in your small room. That's just the way the 20-foot Jesus works. It begins as a fact gatherer, thinking that it is possible that you could prove such a thing, but then ends as a logician and says, okay, well, the positive case has not been produced. So then we'll switch to being a logician and saying, you can't prove a negative. This is something you hear very common. You can't actually prove atheism just because how do you prove the absence of something? Couldn't he just be hiding further? Isn't that, in fact, the way that any sophisticated believer in God doesn't think that he's the kind of thing that at least normally would come forward and identify himself this way, even to individuals? So why would we expect that? I mean, what did you think of this particular move as a charge of inconsistency against the agnostic?
Well, for me, I just feel like it keeps coming back to the idea of humility and admitting limits of reason, that slamming the agnostic, you know, they're saying that, look, you either have to go with your head or go with your glands in deciding which way you're going to tip between atheist and theist. Say, well, maybe the agnostic has a belief in the possible limits of their perception, their ability to perceive something. Maybe the agnostic has some humility that understands that there are things in this universe that are beyond our perception, our ability to reason out. And I would have loved to have seen that argument played out, knocked down or lifted up, but it felt like there was this assumption that all can be conquered if you just choose the method you're going to utilize.
Although, to be fair, his charge is inconsistency. And I mean, in a logical sense, I think he narrates it pretty well. I mean, you know, this is an inconsistent approach to the God question, right? If we're positing an entity called God and you begin by saying, okay, we've got all these instances in which we cannot empirically point to God, and any other oviparous bat scenario, we would say they must not exist. But in this particular case, it's sort of a special pleading, but I'm not sure if that's the name of the fallacy, but it's a case in which a different rule applies to this one particular question.
Well, and that was exactly the point of Flew's 1950 essay that you quoted the end of, is if you admit that, I think most people, you guys are seem a rare exception, that admit that it is possible that we could, through this kind of thing that Hansen describes, all be convinced that God really does exist. You know, if you think that the miracles occurred, if you think that Jesus was appeared to and Jesus did all these miracles, then it does not seem out of the question. Can't we have that too? Can't we get shown that as well? At least it's in the realm of possibility, and that would be convincing. So therefore, just to be consistent, if you're going to say it could be confirmed by evidence, you also say there's some possible evidence that could disconfirm.
So again, I think this is it's an equivocation on this word evidence. So when the agnostic says there's some possible evidence that could confirm, I mean, does the agnostic even grant that? I don't think the agnostic grants that there's some possible evidence that could confirm that God exists.
Point taken. I hadn't even thought of that.
Especially if what you mean by evidence, which I think Hansen seems to mean, is some empirical sort of evidence. I mean, I think many agnostics wouldn't even concede that revelation, some sort of spiritual revelation, would count as evidence. And most of us don't think God is going to appear as an apparition of some kind. So I don't think the agnostic even concedes that from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like Flew actually was the kind of agnostic that Hansen talks about. He was known for his atheism, and there's kind of a flurry of controversy about the end of his life when he was like 80 years old in 2003 that he told somebody in an interview that, you know, I guess I don't really understand how what evolutionary theory is trying to explain in terms of the particular mechanisms by which species evolve. But to get the whole thing kicked off in the first place, to sort of set up the laws by which evolution proceeds, I'm beginning to think now that you would need a God. You know, so basically he converted to deism, not to Christianity, but to deism. There must have been a God to at least kick things off.
Right. You know, I know that Kahn has kind of become Rob's and my center of gravity in this conversation, but that's why his claim, the statement God exists has no moral implications, just resonates with me. Because again, the apparition that Hansen describes, I would be among those people that Wes was just talking about, saying, okay, that's not God, whatever the heck that was. I think it was a space alien.
Chariots of the gods. If the gods had chariots, especially, you should be very suspicious.
Yes, indeed.
You know, I've used that same thing, irrelevance of proof to religion, on the atheist side in here, that by the time I got to this point of starting this podcast in my philosophical career, that the whole question of is there a God just seemed kind of boring to me. This is a very existentialist point, which Kahn makes in here, that it's the point that flows out of Hume's is-ought distinction, that even if there was a God telling you what to do, that doesn't make, and we had a whole podcast on this about Plato's Euthyphro, so I'm not going to try to explain the whole thing right now, but that in itself would not establish that that's what goodness is. In other words, there's a disconnect between what anybody says, even a God, even an all-powerful God, and what the good is. And so the way Kahn puts it is, it's not that the moral aspect is logically prior to the metaphysical aspect, but at least they go hand in hand, that you buy into a moral enterprise, you know, you realize that there are things wrong and there's a project by which we should tell people the right way to be. And as Rob referred to, you latch onto a tradition as a way of doing this. And that sort of then all becomes part and parcel of buying into a religion. It's like Nathan was saying, but seeing yourself as part of a narrative here.
Right. And to follow up on that, that's honestly why his assertion that God exists has no moral implications resonated with me, because a narrative that emerges out of a sacred tradition is going to be so much more complex than God exists, right? I mean, for me to be a righteous Muslim is going to involve me in such a wildly different story from the one that makes me a justice-seeking liberal Protestant, that what you're talking about there, in both cases, you can use the English noun God to describe what's going on, but because they are involved in such wildly different stories, you really do need to get into the details to understand what in the world it would mean for someone to be faithful to God.
We definitely got some criticism on the Arguments for the Existence of God episode is, why wouldn't you just start by defining God or something? I always see that as it's kind of problematic because of the various traditions that you're talking about. But yet, come on, we all know what the common thing, what people are talking about. It only slows you down if you insisted before doing anything else. Well, first, let's come up with a definition of God. The podcast would be done before you got to the second step of actually talking about the cosmological argument or something.
I mean, it depends on how robust you want the definition to be, right? It could be an Aristotelian about it and just posit God as this unmoved mover or the creator of the universe, let's say.
Yeah, sure.
And that's sort of the most bare bones conceptual space for God to fill. And then you could elaborate on that to your heart's content or not.
And that seems to be what's at stake in at least that minimal definition. You know, nobody's arguing for a Spinozic God or a Ralph Waldo Emerson God in these kind of debates. It's that those weird, in my mind, more reasonable conceptions need to be treated differently.
Right,
that, you
right.
know, they go along with the pragmatic faith that Swinburne talks about of, oh, I can pursue religion and not even make positive factual claims about a God. Like, no. Most of the time, at least in popular culture, when we're talking about the existence of God, it's kind of what you're saying, Wes.
Well, I think also that for the person who's the believer to try to separate the existence of God from whatever the will of such a God is seems nonsensical, because it's just very hard to pull apart this idea of whether or not there is a God from what is it that this God wills. Those things get so intertwined. I just think that that becomes problematic when you try to just argue the existence of God separate from any statements about such God. I thought that in the episode that y'all did, the Will to Believe episode, that I really enjoyed some of the back and forth that you had about that and about trying to imagine what is this will of such a God that might exist. And in fact, I loved it so much that today in my sermon, Mark, I quoted you from that episode. So
it's a first.
Yeah. So just so
I hope.
Yeah. Well, you never know. And you said something along the lines of, if there is an omnipresent, omniscient God, I highly doubt that he is preoccupied with whether or not I believe in him, that I imagine that he has bigger things to deal with.
Right.
And I just found that fascinating, coming from my own perspective, this idea that, because those kinds of concepts get so intertwined when you come from my little narrative, to borrow Nathan's way of talking about it.
Well, that, Alistair McIntyre's before me, I assure you.
Yeah.
So did you spend the rest of the sermon ripping that down? What was the response there?
Yeah, I said, like, can you believe that load of bull? No.
Hey, we've got the explicit tag on this podcast already. Yeah. Please take advantage of it.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. So
did you burn a copy of the podcast?
We did. We threw it out there like, yeah.
Unbeliever.
Yeah, we brought forth a shrubbery and it was all good. Actually, what we talked about was that, no, God doesn't need you to believe in him, but you need to believe in him. And the people around you need you to believe in him, that walk of faith is a community event, and that our ability to express whatever faith we have in whatever amounts or strengths is imperative to our story together. But no, the Lord God Almighty does not lose sleep over whether or not Mark believes in him, but the rest of us would be better off if Mark did. And Mark would be too in my little world.
What Rob just narrated shows why the particular character of the God is so important, because if indeed God is the Logos and the Logos became flesh, then it makes sense to say that whatever this omnipresent, omniscient God is also a human body, and therefore would experience a certain sort of sympathy towards Mark Linsenmeyer, and therefore would be concerned that Mark Linsenmeyer lives a certain kind of human life that is intelligibly good. right? Now, whether that means that Mark comes to my church or he burns in hell, I don't think that's the point at all. I don't think that's the case, by the way.
Thank God.
On the other hand, you know, if you're in the Mary Surah of the Quran and, you know, well, what is Allah? Well, whatever it is, it's not human body. Okay, definitely not human body. Can't have a human body. Then in that case, those sorts of concerns are going to take on a very different cast ethically. I know I keep beating this drum, but, you know, when a lot of these writers, not all of them, posit this, what I think of as sort of a plain vanilla God concept, it just strikes me as so foreign to the life of Islam or the life of Judaism or the life of Catholicism or the life of evangelical Protestantism like me, that I regarded all of these arguments sort of at arm's distance. They never really got into my head the way that, for instance, Friedrich Nietzsche does when he really digs into the writings of Tertullian or Aquinas or something like that and says, okay, this is your intellectual tradition. What do you think about the implications of it?
All right, so that seems a good place to stop. This has been but the first half of the discussion. Please tune in next week for part two. Though I gotta tell you, these two parts were recorded as one discussion and are best listened to that way, uninterrupted by ads, and you can do so by becoming a Partially Examined Life citizen at partiallyexaminedlife.com for a mere $5. And so you'll be able to go right now and grab the full Citizen Edition and never have to wait for the second week, never have to listen to more advertisements. Hey, and I want to remind you another reason to go to partiallyexaminedlife.com right now. As announced at the beginning of this episode, the Partially Examined Life 2016 calendar is now available for ordering, as is the Mark Lint CD, Songs from the Partially Examined Life, chock full of your favorite philosophy-influenced music created for these podcast episodes. So check out partiallyexaminedlife.com/store. And we want to remind you, this podcast has been brought to you by Zevia, the zero-calorie, naturally sweetened soda that is clearly different. No sugar, no calories, and non-GMO Project Verified make this a cleaner, healthier soda option. Zevia is available in 15 delicious flavors like cream soda, black cherry, cola, ginger ale, and tonic water. Always zero calories, and they make excellent mixers. Go to Zevia.com/podcast, because Zevia is giving away thousands of free six-packs. Head to Zevia.com/podcast to get yours. That's Zevia.com/podcast. All right, good night.